Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, memories of President Jimmy Carter in Sullivan County. The President and First Lady visited in 1984 for a five-day visit of fly fishing. We'll speak to Judy Van Putt, who accompanied the Carters on their visit and fished with them, about her memories of the late President. Governor Kathy Hochul signs a $75 billion climate Superfund bill targeting oil companies into law. The Superfund bill was a top climate priority this year. It will likely face court challenges from major fuel producers. We'll get more about the law to hold fossil fuel companies responsible for climate impacts. New Hope Manor is a place of hope and transformation, helping women rebuild their lives from struggles of substance abuse. We'll learn more about the impact they're making. And James B. Huntington with Work Shift Live, local economic perspective. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Biden has declared January 9th as a day of national mourning for former President Jimmy Carter. He died yesterday at the age of 100. He'd been in hospice care for more than a year. Carter served as the nation's 39th president for one term, winning election in 1976. Despite notable accomplishments, he was voted out of office with anger over soaring inflation and the Iran hostage crisis. NPR Stephen Fowler says that Carter drew acclaim for work after he left the White House.
His signature work with the eponymous Carter Center, along with his late wife Rosalind, vowed to, quote, wage peace through work on democracy, global health, human rights, including effectively eradicating this parasitic disease, the guinea worm, in Africa. He was also awarded the Nobel Peace Prize.
NPR's Stephen Fowler reporting. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in the hospital recovering from what doctors say was a successful surgery to remove his prostate. His hospitalization comes at a critical time. NPR's Kerry Khan reports Netanyahu is standing trial for alleged corruption, and Israel is fighting wars on multiple fronts.
Doctors say Netanyahu's surgery went well and that, quote, there was no fear of cancer or malignancy. They added that, quote, we only hope for the best. The Prime Minister's office said Netanyahu was fully conscious and is recuperating in a bomb-proof underground recovery unit. Netanyahu is expected to remain in the hospital for several days. Judges in his trial on corruption charges granted Netanyahu a three-day recess. At 75, he is one of the world's oldest leaders today. He has had health issues before, including a heart condition. Critics in Israel say they're concerned about his health as he deals with the war in Gaza, active troops in Lebanon and Syria, and battles with Houthi rebels in Yemen. Kerry Khan, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The World Meteorological Organization warns this year's record-breaking heat is likely to continue next year. It'll speed up climate change. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva. The WMO is calling for urgent action.
WMO reports 2024 is set to be the warmest year on record. The United Nations Weather Agency says climate change has increased the number and impact of extreme weather events in all regions of the world. That included Hurricane Helene, which hit Florida, causing widespread flooding and wind damage. Historic flooding across West and Central Africa killed more than 1,500 people. Raging wildfires and severe drought have caused irreparable suffering and huge economic losses to countless millions. WMO is urging nations to slash the use of fossil fuel and promote renewable energy. For NPR News, I'm Lisa Schlein in Geneva.
Stocks are falling on Wall Street. The Dow was down 685 points. The Nasdaq is down 350. This is NPR. In South Korea, investigators are trying to discover what caused yesterday's plane crash south of Seoul. 179 people were killed when the jet landed at the airport. The plane's landing gear was not deployed. It exploded after it crashed into a concrete barrier. Officials say they've recovered the plane's flight data recorders. The passenger jet was a Boeing 737-800 model. South Korean authorities will inspect all of these Boeing models now in service with the country's airlines. A new study looks at the effects of artificial light at night on coral reefs. NPR's Jonathan Lambert explains.
Coral reefs exposed to artificial light at night are a lot more active, according to research published in the journal Global Change Biology. Artificial light attracts more predatory fish and keeps daytime fish that would otherwise be asleep up and foraging for food. This could lead to less productive reefs over time. But the researchers say that simple actions, like turning off unnecessary lights or using motion detectors, can help preserve these ecosystems. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
Award-winning actress Linda Lavin has died of complications from recently discovered lung cancer, according to her representative. She was 87 years old. Lavin won a Tony Award for the play Broadway Bound. Later, she won two Golden Globes. Those were some of her most beloved work. She played the title character on the TV show Alice. Launched in 1976, it featured a widowed woman who raised a son and worked as a waitress in Phoenix. Funeral services for Lavin have not been announced. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As you've heard from NPR News, former President Jimmy Carter died at 100 on Sunday. He was a peanut farmer who turned president, a humanitarian, statesman, novelist, Nobel Prize laureate, and fly fisherman. 40 years ago, President Carter and First Lady Rosalind Carter made an historic five-day visit to Sullivan County. The Carters were invited to come and fish the beaver kill and participate in fundraising events for the recently formed Catskill Fly Fishing Center. Judy Van Putt is a longtime member of the New York State Outdoor Writers Association, and she was one of the community members who hosted and fished with the president and first lady on their 1984 visit, and she shares her memories.
The Carters were invited by Frank Polinish, who was a director of the newly formed Catskill Fly Fishing Museum, to spend time fishing the Beaverkill and Delaware River as a fundraiser, raising money for a fly fishing center and museum to be constructed along the banks of the Willowemoc, halfway between Livingston Manor and Roscoe. The group was formed back in the late 1970s by a small group of dedicated area residents, and arrangements for the trip were made by Livingston Manor's Dr. Alan Freed and attorney Joe Horak, who were president and vice president at the time of the Catskill Fly Fishing Museum. They said that President Carter said he found the letter of invitation so enticing that he couldn't resist. He had been fly fishing for about 15 years and agreed with the Catskill Fly Fishing Museum's goal of preserving the history and heritage of the region. He thought that fishing these special waters that he had read about, he referred to them as the Mecca, which draws other fly fishermen, made it impossible to turn down. And it was really exciting, as Jimmy Carter was the first American president to visit the Catskills and fish our waters.
He was also one of the few presidents who was an angler while in office. How were his fly fishing skills?
Great. He was a very competent fisherman. As was Mrs. Carter. They both caught a good number of fish. In fact, the first night that they arrived, we didn't know what to expect. There was a dinner scheduled at the Beaverkill Valley Inn where the Carters would stay. And there were about two dozen Catskill fly fishing celebrities and officers there. And Joe Horak, the organizer, was startled when the Carters arrived, and Mr. Carter said he wanted to get right out on the stream and start fishing rather than resting up before dinner. Also, Ed, my husband, was his guide, and Ed said that when they were fishing the Delaware River, President Carter was a fearless wader. He crossed the river with Ed at his side, much to the dismay of the Secret Service agents who were always there, as the water was up to the top of their waders. And Ed said he loved fishing so much that it was difficult to get the president to leave the stream in order to make all the dinner and luncheon dates on time. And he said, "Mr. President, I think it would be easier to tell you that you lost an election than to tell you it's time to leave the river."
And then the following morning, I understand that they fished the Upper Beaverkill with Joan and Lee Wolf, who are undoubtedly the best-known husband-wife fly fishing team in the world. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
They did. They fished the upper Beaver Kill that next morning. Both caught fish, really enjoyed themselves. You know, they were extremely enthusiastic, and as I said, that they were very competent at fishing. I think the president had caught 10 to 12 trout on a small Adams, and Mrs. Carter caught fish as well. So they were quite excited. They came with their friend Jack Crockford. He was the head of their conservation department in Georgia, and they all fished. The nice thing was that interspersed with fishing all these different sections of the stream, the Carters were taken to various places to visit. They visited what was known as the Oak Table and had lunch there. One day they had lunch at Frank Polinish's farm. One day they went to Calicoon. On their way to Calicoon, they stopped at the old North Branch Cider Mill. And Ed had a little story that the trip to the cider mill was really fun. And the man who was at the cider press informed Mr. Carter that on that day they were pressing apples from Georgia. And they headed to the Autumn Inn in Calicoon, where they were to meet with a friend of the president's mother, Miss Lillian, who was a priest that she had known when she was in the Peace Corps. So they really made their way around the area and got to sample fishing in different sections of the Beaver Kill and the Delaware.
It was Ed that was his guide for that part of the trip on the Delaware, right?
Well, Ed was his guide for all 5 days. So he was with him breakfast, lunch, and dinner for all 5 days, and just had such a wonderful time. I have kind of a funny anecdotal story. I was in my 20s, and our children were, Tyler was a couple months old, and Lee was just about 2. And for the week before the Carters came, Ed had been scouting all the rivers in the area to monitor the fishing conditions. And as a result, our car hadn't been cleaned and was a terrible mess. So I said, be sure to park in the upper parking lot of the inn so it'll be out of the way and no one would notice it. And the Carters, of course, traveled with an entourage of Secret Service agents all during the trip. But after fishing the Delaware the first day, he left the Secret Service vehicle that he and Mrs. Carter were traveling in and said he was going to go with Ed and ride in his car back to the press conference and dinner at the Antrim Lodge in Roscoe. And Ed said, oh, my wife will be so embarrassed. We didn't have time to clean the car. It's got 2 baby car seats, kids' toys, McDonald's wrappers. And he said, that's okay. I have children of my own. And it wasn't that long ago that my daughter Amy was a young child.
It seems like he really enjoyed himself and had a lot of fun.
He did, and he just had this warmth and made people feel instantly at ease. The first night he arrived, we were at the dinner at the Beaver Kill Valley Inn, and I was nervous as I saw him making his way around the table, coming over to us, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, here comes the former president of the United States, until he came and he put one hand on each of our shoulders and said, I heard you were married on the banks of the Beaver Kill, and that you have 2 small children. So I said, yes. And he surprised us even more when he asked when would he be able to meet the boys and said that he'd like to have his picture taken with them, which he did when he visited the Catskill fly fishing property on Friday. But his personality was so warm, made people feel at ease. Everywhere he went, the townspeople came out in droves and were so excited. On Friday, when he stopped at the Catskill Museum property to visit the new bridge site, there was a delegation of students and teachers from Livingston Manor School that greeted him and presented him with gifts. And it was there that my mother, my mother-in-law, and my 2 boys, who were an infant and toddler at the time, and I went to meet them and have our pictures taken, as he suggested. The next stop was at the temporary Catskill Fly Fishing Museum office in Roscoe. And there was a huge Welcome Jimmy Carter banner hanging over Main Street in the town. And it appeared as though all the townsfolk of Roscoe came out, including a delegation from Roscoe School who also presented gifts. And after he walked into the little store, which was the outdoor store in Roscoe, where Bob Bach, the proprietor, informed him that he was having a sale on fishing boots. And the president purchased a pair of hip boots, and for many years, Bob never cashed the check, but hung down the wall above his cash register. And then on Sunday, which was the last of the five-day trip, the Carters visited the little Methodist church up in Lou Beach. And the Reverend at the time, Betty Beach, led the service. Usually there would be 9 to 17 people. But on that day, the church was overflowing with about 68. Many arrived an hour early. Some were listening from the stairs and outside the structure. And the Carters participated and sang hymns during the service, which lasted about 75 minutes.
He was an accomplished sportsman and statesman, humanitarian. How will you remember President Carter?
I have a couple of lasting memories from the trip. The first that I have is the goodness and kindness that emanates from him. His voice is ingrained in my mind. And as a result, it doesn't take but a few words of hearing him speak on the radio or on television that just makes me feel goodness and kindness wash over me. He is truly remarkable. And the second long-lasting memory, I'm reading his book now, A Full Life, and he tells the story that he was born in October of 1924, and his family lived next door to the Smith family. And the Smith's daughter, Rosalyn, was born in August of 1927. And Jimmy Carter's mother later told him that he was 3 years old and taken to the house next door and peeked in the cradle to see the newest baby on the street. Their families were very close, and Jimmy and Rosalyn became high school sweethearts. So my second long-lasting memory of the trip was that he and Rosalyn were always holding hands, even sometimes on the stream, walking along the stream, walking in and out of the vehicles, and their love for each other is very apparent.
Thank you so much for taking time to share your memories of that special visit and of President Carter. We appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you. It was my pleasure and my honor.
Judy Van Putt sharing her memories of former President Carter's visit to Sullivan County 40 years ago. By the way, the goals of the fundraising organizers were met and even exceeded as the Fly Fishing Center raised between $40,000 and $50,000, enough to establish the fund for the museum. President Biden has designated January 9th as a day of mourning for President Carter. There will be a state funeral service at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., and then an internment service in Georgia. NPR intends to offer live special coverage of the Carter events, and we will bring you that coverage here on Radio Catskill. We'll take a break, and when we come back, local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington. This is Radio Catskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, a conversation with Adam Moss, widely considered the best magazine editor of his generation.
There would be these story meetings and people would cry.
Moss, the editor, has now written a book.
It's so hard. It's the dialogue in your head that was driving me completely crazy and why I never was a writer in the first place.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday at 1 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. This week on Latino USA, how the death of a young woman on a university campus fueled a movement to combat the crime of femicide in Mexico.
If they kill me, it'll be because I walk alone at night. If they kill me, they'll say it was because I was flirtatious and I said no.
That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and it's Monday and the end of the year, and we're going to get some local economic perspective from our local economist, local author, James B. Huntington. Good morning, James B.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Well, here we are, James B., end of the year, but we're going to look ahead a little bit now. What do you have in your crystal ball for the economy in 2025? What's ahead, do you think?
Well, actually, this is Barron's magazine's crystal ball, and Nicholas Jasinski wrote this. So what's up for the economy next year? Conclusions, and he has in this fairly long, well-put-together article. For now, there's good reason to expect continued economic growth and more interest rate cuts in the month ahead. One projection here is that there will be two over the next year, finishing by summer. Not as many as last time, but then again, it's quite a bit lower. The labor market has reason for optimism, where unemployment is still relatively low. The Fed's inflation measure, the core personal consumption expenditures, he's expecting that it will stay about the same, maybe a little bit lower. It's not going to reach the 2% target, but it's not really expected to gust up much more than that. As far as Trump's plans for the economy, the tariffs, what he has, even his reduced plan for tariffs, would increase what people are paying a total of sevenfold if it happens, and we don't know if it'll happen at all. Also, problems with undocumented immigrants being removed, and that could raise the price by cutting down supply of things. On the other hand, if he does put in tax cuts for individuals and businesses, and a lot of deregulation, all of those things could pick up demand and offset some of the other things. So, there we are.
What about the tech sector and the job market for that part of the economy for 2025?
Well, we finished 2024 with a lousy 6 months, and it took a while for people to realize, other than anecdotally, that it was a formal thing, but it certainly was. Now, we're looking in general, and this is from a senior contributor at Forbes, we're looking in general for an improvement, a bounce back somewhat in 2025. The catch is that companies are being more discriminant about who they choose. They want people with the top credentials. They want people with really from the top 10 or 20% of the applicants they get. Those people will get healthy offers. There's more emphasis these days on paying people enough so that they won't leave for another company and that you'll take your offer, because in the top few percent of technical job applicants, there often are multiple offers and a lot of possibilities there. So if you see yourself as one of the best out there, it may be a big improvement, because even those types weren't doing as well during a lot of this past year. So AI, there will continue to be a lot of emphasis on AI. And even when they hire software engineers for other kinds of work, they're still hoping that they have some AI-related competencies, and including some engineering skills and ability to integrate AI into products, because that's going to be a big thing next year, adding AI to existing products for which they'll need engineering.
So they're prioritizing AI skills for folks coming into the tech sector.
Yes, they're important even if you're not applying for an AI job as such. They will value it, because there may be a lot of combinations of things going back and forth between opportunities in organizations with and without AI, where they can kind of merge them together, or assign people into AI-related things, even if they weren't hired from that, if they have that option.
Okay, well,
overall, it's good if you're one of the best. Otherwise, it may be no stronger than 2024.
Right. We made it through the holiday shopping season. What were the numbers now that they're reporting for holiday sales?
Okay, we have, and this is from Anna's Daybreak News, an up-and-coming consolidation effort that you have from... Compared with the previous year, we have overall holiday retail sales rose 3.8% from last year, driven by online shopping. Online sales were up almost 7%, up about 3% for in-store sales. Jewelry up 4%, electronics up 3.7%, apparel by 3.6%, and... overall, spending was just a little bit short of $1 trillion, with Black Friday and Cyber Monday seeing 3.7% increases. The drivers were households making over $100,000 annually. So that's what happened. It looks awfully good. We can't take an almost 4% increase for granted. We're not growing fast enough to assume that. It easily could have been 1% or 2%. So very good sales over the holidays, for the holidays.
Now clearance sales and returns, I guess, for the end of the year.
Yes, returns are another a horse of a different color.
You've got an interesting tidbit here, too, piqued my interest, and probably will pique the interest of many folks listening. What's the number one rule on the road to becoming a millionaire so you can afford all these holiday gifts?
Okay. The best thing you can do, the most important thing you can do, is max out on your company 401 or savings plan from the beginning. Any way you can do that, if you can mentally take that, even if you're income is relatively low, if there's any way you can stash that away and put it there with the time value of money and with a lot of companies having matching programs of some sort and the protection from taxes, that's the number one thing. Even if you have a job like that, even in your 20s, I know it's a long time to retirement, but that kind of money can really add up. And putting it there and hopefully not wanting to spend it or not doing anything with it can really get you a remarkably immense amount of money by the time you retire.
That's a good tip. Now, normally we ask you about how prices changed from the previous week, which we'll do again. But you not only have price changes for stocks and crypto and oil and all that, you've got numbers for the last, year?
Yes, I have. I have the prices and the changes from 1 week ago and 54 weeks ago. Last year, Christmas and New Year's fell on Mondays, and so I was not on the air then, but it's not too far off. I don't remember anything huge either way happening in the last 13 days of the year. So here we go. Gold, early this morning, $26.14, down $8 for 1 week since last week, but for 54 weeks, up $589, a huge week for gold, a huge year for gold, tremendously good. Silver, $29.38, that's down 31 cents for an 89-to-1 ratio over the last week, and now it went up for the year, for the 54 weeks, $5.34. When the ratio was 84-to-1. So even though it went up so much, silver is still did not do as well as gold this year. And believe you me, I mean, especially physical silver is going for a premium over these prices. Dow Jones Industrial Average, 42,992 early this morning. That's up 152 for the week, recovering a bit from healthy losses previously in December, but for the year, for the 54 weeks, 6,687 to the good. That's about a 15% increase. Congratulations, Dow. NASDAQ did even better, 19,722, up 149 for the week. That's better than the Dow. And for 54 weeks, up 4,908 points. So that went up over 20% even. Tremendous. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, 70.59 for a 97-cent gain over the last week. Pump prices have seemed awfully stable as far as I can tell, but it went down $1.28 for the 54 weeks. Relatively peaceful, but it's moving in the right direction, and it certainly is not shooting up despite all this economic strength in other areas. Bitcoin, 93,740, down 21.98 for the previous week for sort of a maximum random fluctuation, but for the year, for the 54 weeks, 52,831 to the good. It more than doubled during the past 54 weeks. So tremendous. Pat yourself on the back if you bought Bitcoin at the beginning of the year. British pound, 1.2572. That's down 0.04 of a cent for pretty much nothing, but it was down about a penny over the course of the year. Still have some problems there, and we have really quite strong dollars. Euro, 1.0414, up 0.03, almost nothing for the past week, but since December 18th of last year, down just over a nickel. So the euro is getting weaker, even quite a bit weaker than the pound is. There are problems on the continent, so we'll have keep looking at that. Japanese 100 yen coin, 63 cents for a fourth straight drop of a penny in a week, and it's down 7 cents over the course of the year. Doesn't look good for things in Japan. So overall, this week, everything went up except for Bitcoin, and things seem to be coming back, but we've come within a couple of trading days of nailing down a absolutely superb, fantastic year, no questions asked.
James B. Huntington closing out 2024 with a year in review here and a look back at last week, too. We will see you in the new year. James B. Huntington, local economist and local author on The Economy, joins us every Monday. James B., thanks so much.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll learn more about the Climate Change Superfund Act that Governor Kathy Hochul signed into law late last week. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from JeffWorks Office Solutions, located right on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York. A newly renovated pet-friendly office space that rents by the day, week, or month, with hot desks, sound-insulated rooms, Wi-Fi, modern amenities, and 24-hour secure access. Online at jeffworksjville.com. And from The Cooperage Project, thecooperageproject.org. And listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Radio Catskill is your source for fact-based news and information, whether that's local, national, or from around the world. And while the news of the year reveals deep divisions, it is possible to embrace diversity of thought and build friendships despite differences. This public radio station is uniquely positioned to bridge these divides, but we can't do it without your support. Be part of this good work. Make your year-end donation now at wjffradio.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Governor Kathy Hochul signed the Climate Change Superfund Act into law last week, making New York the second state in the country to hold fossil fuel companies responsible for climate impacts. From the New York Public News Network, WAMC's Capital Region Bureau Chief Dave Lucas reports.
The Climate Superfund law, signed by the Democrat the day after Christmas, establishes a climate change adaptation cost recovery program intended to raise $75 billion over 25 years from gas and oil companies blamed for contributing to climate impacts like flooding and severe heat. Environmental advocates and state legislators alike hailed the development. Third Act Upstate New York climate activist Michael Richardson says the science supporting the law is clear.
The production and burning of fossil fuel is the primary cause of the climate disruption that we're suffering from. With the signing of this Climate Change Superfund Act, which might want to be called the Taxpayer Relief Act, big oil will at long last be held accountable for the damage they sow upon our communities. And they cannot continue to make exorbitant profits, which they've been making over the past few years, by not paying for the destructive consequences.
State Assemblymember John McDonald of the 108th District, a Democrat, expects court challenges.
People can be happy about it today, and you know, I supported it, and who knows, hopefully it'll be successful. But like anything else, I also think it's going to be subject to years and years of litigation, which still puts us in this very difficult spot that we need to make positive and accurate changes to recognize that the climate is changing. In the same token, we need to be mindful of the fact that we need to make sure that these changes don't have a negative adverse impact on the average family's household. If anything has been learned in the last several years, but particularly the last election, affordability is first and foremost in people's minds.
The American Petroleum Institute responded to a request for comment by email, stating, "This type of legislation represents nothing more than a punitive new fee on American energy, and we are evaluating our options moving forward." In May, Vermont became the first state with such a law. Elena Mihaly is the vice president for the Conservation Law Foundation of Vermont.
We are thrilled that New York is now an ally with Vermont in enacting this kind of climate accountability legislation to hold the fossil fuel industry accountable for their fair share in the cost of climate pollution to the states of Vermont and New York. And we actually have a preview of what the American Petroleum Institute's concerns are with the law, because they filed comments in the New York and Vermont legislatures during the adoption of both of the laws that kind of laid out what they felt was either unconstitutional or other concerns with the law. And in Vermont, we had the benefit of that to help make sure that we shaped the law to be defensible to all of those concerns. So we feel very confident about the defensibility of the law, and we are moving forward.
Blair Horner is with the New York Public Interest Research Group.
I think there'll be a bunch of other states that are going to follow what New York does, because the staggering costs of climate change are not going away. And there's two choices. Either the taxpayers pay for it, or the oil companies pay for it. We think it should be the oil companies.
Again, Richardson.
As the next legislative session begins here in January, we need to move beyond the incrementalism that has happened from the legislature and the governor in funding and implementing our landmark Climate Act. We have all the knowledge and tools to transition this New York State economy from fossil fuels to renewables. All that is needed is, quite candidly, the political courage and the political will. Now, that's been demonstrated after 2 years of effort on this Climate Change Superfund bill. And it is landmark in the sense that there are now four other states that are queued up to follow the lead from Vermont and New York.
Hochul said lawmakers agreed to several changes to address implementation and operational concerns, including giving the State Department of Environmental Conservation additional time to create the program. Dave Lucas, WAMC News.
Quick break for us and back with more Radio Chatskill right after this.
I'm Matt Hurtado.
Join me on a journey where pixels meet melodies and controllers become conductors. This is Virtual Soundscapes, the show that transports you to the sonic realms of video game magic. In this journey, we'll uncover the hidden treasures of video game soundtracks from the classics to modern day, and speak with industry veterans. Join me every Thursday night at 10 p.m., only on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. New Hope Manor in Berryville, New York, is a place of hope and transformation, helping women rebuild their lives from the struggles of substance abuse. Sarah Eilbacher, the executive director of New Hope Manor, and Lucy Dalrymple, the clinical supervisor, spoke to Radio Catskill's Patricia Rubio recently about their mission, the unique programs they offer, and the impact they're making in the community.
Our mission is, we are a community. We look at New Hope Manor as not a typical rehab, but a community of people. Our staff are pledged to tend to all of the needs of the women affected by substance use and helping them to reconcile themselves, helping them to reconcile themselves with their community, with themselves, and with their spiritual entity. So basically recreating the whole person that was shattered by the substance use.
And you're located in Berryville, New York, right?
Yeah.
How long have you been in Berryville? How long has the organization been in?
New Hope Manor actually started in 1970 when it was first over at St. Christopher's in Garrison, New York. In 1970, it moved to Poughkeepsie. And then finally here in 1980, we found a home with a former boarding house here in Berryville, New York. Berryville, New Hope Manor, has been here since 1980.
Wow, great. Lacey, maybe you answer this one. New Hope Manor focuses on women's, helping women take control of their lives. How is this different from other recovery programs?
I think our program is different in that we are very hands-on. We have multiple groups per day, five different group times per day, where the patients get a choice between about four different groups per hour. We are very dedicated to having a mix of therapeutic groups, recovery-based groups, fun groups, team-building groups. I think that right there and right off the bat makes us different. I know other programs don't have as much structure, very structured program. We look at the thoughts, attitudes, and behaviors because addiction, the drug is the solution. The real problem is things like not loving yourself, stuff you went through in the past. So we look at not just the whole person, but also just we address the false attitudes and behaviors because that's what needs to be changed. And it's about becoming your best version of yourself.
If I can piggyback off of that, we are licensed by OCFS. We have a mother infant program here, which makes us very unique and special. New Hope Manor was the first all-female licensed by OASIS Rehabilitation Center. So that makes us unique as well. But back to the mother infant, we have a licensed daycare here on site, which means mothers can come here with their children under the age of three. Their children attend daycare during the day while the moms can attend treatment services. And the child resides here with mom. We have mother infant rooms set up for children to be in a home-like environment. And we feel that makes us also very special. We're also one of the first substance use facilities to become an 820 program back in 2017, which basically means we offer more medical, mental health, and individualized services now that we're 820. We have a medical director. We have nursing on site. But we also have social workers here to provide individual and group psychotherapy. And we're finding a lot more of the women coming in are coming in with co-occurring disorders due to several things, especially trauma in their past. And we can individualize that when they get here, especially with our certified staff.
I think really it's great that you have some kind of daycare within the facility just because that could be a barrier for some folks.
We also currently have four pregnant women. So they will be participating in their treatment here, but they will also go to a local hospital where they'll be giving birth, but then they'll return here with their newborn they have specific bonding time and before the infant goes into daycare after they're shot and everything. So it's a home away from home. It's a beautiful setting here in rural Berryville. And it's quite different from what a lot of our women are used to coming from Long Island, from other major cities all over New York State.
One question I had is, how does a woman gets referred to you? I'm sure it happens in multiple ways. Is it happened because did it come to you directly or some other way that would tell us that part?
Women come to us in a variety of different ways. There's self-referrals. They hear about us, whether it's through our website, through word of mouth, meeting other people that have been here. We also get through legal entities such as probation or like a drug court will refer a patient here, hospitals, other programs. Sometimes when a individual completes like a 28-day, they are looking for more intensive treatment and they'll come for the long-term treatment here. Yeah, they're all different. And I'm from all different counties. We come from all over New York. We have patients come from.
It's not just, make it clear, it's not just Sullivan County. It's all across the New York State that folks can come to you.
Yeah.
Right. Then you mentioned some of the programs or tools that are used to help women on their journey to recovery. Can you go to and tell us what are some of the programs and tools that you do use?
Sure. Well, you know, I'll just start with some of our groups and some of the evidence-based modalities we utilize. For example, we have conflict resolution. We have where we're teaching the women how to solve problems with proper communication. A lot of times when they're coming in new to recovery, they don't know how to communicate properly, or they were never taught, or they were so wrapped up in their addiction that communication went out the door. Conflict resolution is definitely something that we focus on here. We also provide dialectical behavior therapy along with cognitive behavior therapy. Good old motivational interviewing that occurs mostly within our counselors' sessions. Our women each have a counselor and a social worker. So that when they're working with their counselor, most often they're doing more motivational interviewing and CBT, changing their thought processes. Other groups we have an exercise group. We have a walking group. We have codependency group. We have trauma group. We have so many different individualized groups that the women can pick their groups when they come in. For example, if somebody's struggling with anger management, they can sign up for our anger management course. If they want to work on their GED, we have a GED prep course. If they want to work on job skills and interviewing, perhaps they might participate in the job skills class. We have a variety from job skills to more physical, healthy, to more of the thinking process, the trauma group. We have family group looking at children of alcoholics. We have tons.
When you're hearing all this stuff that the programs that you do offer, which is great, do you have any sort of success stories that you or a moment that you could share with us? Of course, you don't have to give names or anything like that. That you saw a woman come to you and you saw her life transform through your program.
I think there's been a lot of success here that I've seen. I've been here about 7 years. And it's amazing to see women walk through this door and watch the change happen. Watch the click of, hey, I don't have to put chemicals in my body to live a happy life. So that's just a blanket statement, but it's really amazing to see. And we do have a lot of women that keep in touch with us. A lot of women that will come back. We do like a comeback event every year. And so we have
alumni
come back, and it's amazing to see these women where they are at in their lives and how they've been successful and how the accomplishments that they've made. Also, too, with moms coming in, I can think of a woman who successfully completed our program a couple of months ago who was just recently in touch, still doing well, still living a life of recovery, but she came in not having custody of her child. Long story short, because of the work that she put in here, CPF was involved, but eventually she regained custody of her child, was able to bring him here to treatment with her. And basically that family unit was reunited. That to me says it all. Because somebody's addicted doesn't mean there's no hope. It's getting them usually out of their environment and providing hope for them when they don't have hope for themselves. So the reunifying of family, even if they don't have children, just seeing mom and dad coming to visit, seeing those relationships being repaired makes it all worth it.
And you have it right in your name, New Hope. You're basically just giving them an open life.
Absolutely.
Yeah. A stigma and substance abuse the stigma around it is still a challenge. And how does New Hope Manor help women overcome the shame and build confidence in their new lives?
I always say knowledge is power. So providing as much education as possible. A lot of times the women don't understand what happens to their brain chemically when they become addicted. Basically, the oldest portion of your brain starts taking over. It's do or die. And so I think education, psychoeducation is very powerful. The more that they know and understand about their addiction, the more likely they are to take that information and use it in a positive manner. Also, we provide orientation for family members, and that's a good forum to help them to understand why Susie might be acting this way, or helping them to understand the why behind the what. Like Lacey was saying before, those behaviors and attitudes, those don't change in a day. It takes time. And I think teaching family members, teaching other support members, the nature of addiction, it's well beyond the drugs. And looking at the human being in front of you, taking the stigma away, this is somebody's mother we're treating. This is somebody's daughter who have been through tremendous trauma. And quite frankly, no wonder they turned to drugs or alcohol to help them cope. When they get in here, we're teaching them how to cope with life, because life is not easy and drugs are not the way to go. But they don't understand that until they get in here, nor do family members a lot of time. I think looking at the human in front of you helps to reduce the stigma.
What are your hopes in future for New Hope Manor? Are there any new goals or plans that you're excited about in the upcoming new year?
I always think about expanding services and continuing to get the word out about New Hope. This summer, we were at full census. We have 53 beds here at New Hope Manor. We're full quite a bit. Right now, we're not full. So we always want to get those beds filled. We know there's a need. I think continuing to expand outreach where our admissions department is definitely a goal for next year. Although we're very well known across New York State by legal entities and other CPS, not everybody still knows New Hope Manor. So I think increasing outreach, also long-term, year, 2-3 years, perhaps opening up an aftercare or supportive living house here in Berryville. A lot of times aftercare is very challenging for some of our women. So I would love to see a supportive living house right here in Berryville for women to go to after finishing our program in Berry on the rehabilitation level. We have a Poughkeepsie house also. It's a 10-bed supportive living or reintegration house. The women up there can work. They still have a counselor. They still have services, but they have a lot more independence as they're reintegrating into society. So I'd love to see something like that here, because most of our women from Berryville go to Poughkeepsie. Not all of them, but all of the women in Poughkeepsie right now are from Berryville. They successfully competed here and stepped down a level. That's a goal I'd like to see accomplished here in Berryville.
You mentioned, you know, almost at capacity sometimes. You've been in Berryville for so long. Have you seen the need grow or more folks coming using your recovery program? Either pre-pandemic or post-pandemic, have you seen a growth in unfortunate growth?
Absolutely. Since the pandemic, we got down to 8 patients in 2020, and we've shot back up rather quickly. Definitely seen an increase occurring alongside substance use since the pandemic. Like I said, we're taking a lot more women with co-occurring disorders since that pandemic started in 2020.
Wow. It was amazing. Lacey and Sarah, before we go, is there anything else we have not touched on you want folks to know about?
I think that just letting everybody know that we are here and we have open beds. If you are a family member, if you know somebody or have a family member that's struggling with substance use, please give us a call. We also do have a stabilization track here, and we offer medical services for mild to moderate withdrawal under the guidance of our medical director. So we're here. It's interesting. A lot of people close to us in Sullivan County don't know about us as much as some people do in Long Island. I think I just want people here in Sullivan to know more about New Hope. And if anybody ever wants a tour, they can give us a call.
Yes, exactly. Well, where can folks get more information? You want to give out your website and phone number?
Sure. Go ahead, Lee.
So website is just manor.org. Very simple. And our phone number, 845-557-8353.
All right.
And the last thing I do want to say is we've been talking about the language in our mission and vision statements with our board of directors, and it keeps coming back to we're New Hope Manor. We're going to provide that hope before you hope or believe in yourself. This is their home. We're six to 12 months, even past 12 months. It's a very home-like, warm atmosphere. It's a community of women learning how to love themselves, and the staff are loving them a lot of times before they can love themselves. So that compassion and that the relationships that occur here are something very special that you don't see in a 28-day program.
We're talking to Sarah, the executive director for New Hope Manor, and we're talking to Lacey, clinical supervisor, also for New Hope Manor in Berryville, New York. Both of you, thank you so much for talking to me about this. Your organization is great. I didn't know much about your organization, to be honest with you, so I'm really great that I learned more, because like I said, more folks need to know about this service that we have here, especially with the way things are going. So thank you so much, both of you, for talking to me. I do really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
And that'll do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. A reminder that you can hear this show and all of our local programming at our website, wjffradio.org. And while you're there, you might consider making a year-end donation. You have another day to get it in before the end of the year. Just go to wjffradio.org. And thanks for listening, and thanks for your support. I'm Tim Bruno. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Good time, a good time. We gon' have a time.
We got a globe-trotting party this year. Chucho Valdez, Ibrahim Maluf, Ranky Tanky, Lisa Fisher, and Jose James in Amsterdam.
When we all get together, we gon' have time.
Join us on Toast of the Nation from NPR Music. I'm Christian McBride.
Tomorrow night at 9 on Radio Catskill.
Now is the time to support Radio Catskill and take advantage of the 2024 tax benefits.
If you're taking a required minimum distribution, or RMD, from your retirement account, sending a charitable donation directly from your financial institution may provide you with a tax advantage.
Consult your financial advisor about including Radio Catskill in your end-of-the-year giving today.
And find more ways to donate at WJFFradio.org.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's weather, breezy and mild with some sun, then increasing clouds, a high of 45. Clearing tonight, a low of 30. And tomorrow, some sun, then turning cloudy, a high 43. Rain overnight. And on Wednesday, it looks like there might be some snow lasting throughout the day, a high 40, low 27. And high winds expected on Thursday with gusts up to 35 miles an hour. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Radio Catskill supporters include the Sterling Business and Technology Park, located at Exit 17 on Interstate 84 in Northeast Pennsylvania, offering opportunities to locate or expand businesses on property zoned for manufacturing and other uses. More information at sterlingbusinesspark.com. And listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.